We're going to continue talking about Iowa, but first, today's podcast is brought to you by
Theraflu.
Theraflu.
Oh my God! I should have dialed in.
Well, if I didn't have to be around f***ing people all the time, maybe I wouldn't be sick.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The Iowa caucus is exactly 3 weeks away, and the race there could hardly be closer. The latest Des Moines Register poll out this past Friday shows all four leading candidates within 5 points of each other. Sanders is leading the pack at 20%, Warren is at 17%, Buttigieg is at 16%, and Biden is at 15%. So today, we're going to spend a good amount of time talking about the state of the race in Iowa as it comes down to the wire. Also, just this morning, Monday morning, Cory Booker announced he's dropping out of the Democratic primary. So what does his failure to launch really tell us about the Democratic Party? And here with me to discuss are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Yay, happy birthday.
I'm a little under the weather on my birthday, but I am experiencing a birthday. So, yeah, it's good.
How does it feel to be 29?
Never felt better.
Good to hear.
He's like, never felt better.
Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good.
Just back from Iowa.
Yeah.
Just in time to talk about Iowa.
Yeah.
How is it there?
It's cold. Snowy. I was a little salty because people were texting me from New York being like, it's 65. And it was like 12 degrees in Des Moines the whole weekend.
If you had to rate Iowa as an above average or below average state?
I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
Let's not kid ourselves.
Let's lose a bunch of listeners out of the gate.
No, I will say this. In 2016, Micah, Nate, and I were in a car together driving back from something late at night through like Iowa cornfields. And we had this conversation that I always think of when I'm like,
I don't remember this.
It was, would you rather walk down the most dangerous street in New York by yourself? Or would you rather walk by yourself in the middle of the night into a cornfield in Iowa?
Great conversation.
And it was like, and I would do dangerous street any day of the week.
Any day.
Because probably nothing's going to happen to you in the cornfield, but if it does, it's the worst thing possible. And I had like a really long drive Saturday night from Davenport back to Des Moines, really dark, snowy, and I just kept on thinking about that.
That's dark. Also here with us is managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Good. The other thing, just to add on to Claire's thing, is when you've lived in the city for a long time, you get really used to it there being some light all the time.
Yes.
So when I go home to visit my parents, who live in the suburbs, it's not like they live in the sticks, and I walk my dog at night, I take my dog for like super short walks because I'm like terrified of how dark it is outside cities.
Or like if you've ever gone camping in a place where there's zero light pollution and you, in the middle of the night you have to go to the bathroom, man, that is terrifying.
We are like literally the worst coastal elites right now.
Speak for yourself. I like camping.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it's scary
to pee outside in total blackness.
But we're about to have a segment talk about everything we know about Iowa and we're like, it's scary outside of cities.
I mean, the cornfield's not voting though. No, right? The people are voting.
We're from the West. We're qualified.
I'm not from the Midwest.
Where are you from?
The East Coast.
Pennsylvania.
Outside Philly.
The Midwest.
Eastern PA is not the Midwest.
It's not.
Well, now that we've sorted that out, let's talk about Cory Booker dropping out of the primary. First of all, why is Cory Booker dropping out now?
He wasn't going to win.
He was at 2% in the polls. He was not raising a lot of money. He wasn't qualified for the debates. He didn't really have a path. Undermine the whole segment there, the whole drama?
No, it doesn't have to be a very long segment.
I was just going to say, I kind of like Nate's voice. Kind of is like...
Sultry.
Yeah.
Well, Kathleen Turner.
Claire, what does his lack of success in the primary tell us about the Democratic Party?
Couple things. I think, first and foremost, I think the conventional wisdom around, frankly, like Cory Booker and Julian Castro have talked about themselves before they dropped out and probably when they dropped out in the case of Booker, Democratic primary voters are, for whatever reason, and I think I know the reason, not supporting black candidates in the way that I think people thought they would. And that's probably because people are very worried about the quote-unquote electability issues in certain Midwestern states that have a lot of white swing voters. And secondly, I think the thing that's interesting about Booker and what I think it says about our election ecosystem is that he wasn't kind of like a new thing, right? He was the bright and shiny object from 15 years ago or something, right? But the idea that Bernie Sanders is kind of, frankly, a little bit still of a new thing as a national phenomenon, even though, you know, his newness is 4 or 5 years old. And someone like, you know, Pete Buttigieg stole some of Cory Booker's thunder literally on a couple of points, being the smarty pants Rhodes Scholar and being the precocious mayor. And I think that made a big difference for Booker's campaign. It's just that it was like a duller sheen. And that's not, and I think a lot of Booker supporters would say, that's not fair. This guy is a really talented speaker. He's a, you know, a brilliant person.
More qualified, arguably.
He has more electoral and elected office experience. And, you know, it just kind of fell flat.
I think for all those reasons, I'm not inclined to like ascribe a lot of meaning to Booker's failure or to draw a lot of lessons from it. Because as Claire said, on the one hand, okay, maybe being a black candidate, the search for an electable quote unquote candidate hurt him, right? On the other hand, who does Booker bear the most kind of electoral similarities to? Obama, who was super electable, right? And in some ways, since Obama, Democrats have been looking for someone to recapture that coalition.
But yeah, I mean, you would think of, I mean, I still think one of the more interesting moments is this moment relatively recently in the primary where you have rich donors and some establishment types expressing dissatisfaction with the top four.
Yeah.
And instead of what I would think the most obvious alternatives were, which were at the time Harris was still running, so let's get behind Harris, Klobuchar, or Booker.
Yeah.
They instead had more exotic ideas like Michael Bloomberg and Deval Patrick, right?
It's so weird.
That was a pretty weird moment.
So, okay, why didn't Booker succeed? I think the simplest explanation is for some of the reasons we've been talking about, but also just that it was a really crowded field. Most candidates are going to fail. Booker, you know, was, as Claire was saying, was crowded out by Buttigieg in the smarty pants lane, was crowded out by Harris for a little bit, maybe in the like alternative to Biden establishment lane, and sort of just never came together for him. That's not like a very poli-sci answer, but it's, you know.
Well, I mean, yeah, you can definitely say that, hey, look, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, take those three for now, right, are all big, very popular brands, and that Biden, and to some extent Sanders, but more Biden, has a lot of support and faith in the African-American community and endorsers and so forth. Throughout the primary, I always kind of backed Biden in that community for the most part. But still, I'm certainly someone who I think I'm on the record as saying, like, I would have thought it would be unlikely you'd wind up with a primary between all these really old white people, especially two, like, kind of white men who are now old, you know, same age, almost one and two. And that's like, I don't know, maybe it means that identity doesn't matter as much, but it also is a sign of, like, the support that Biden has in the black community.
You've described Booker a little bit as kind of the heir to at least the image that Obama had. Does Booker's lack of success tell us something about the appeal of an Obama type in the Democratic Party today? Or is it just Biden is more of actually the heir to Obama's political success because he was his VP? Can we draw any conclusions there?
We could maybe tentatively draw some. I think both of those are probably true. I think maybe Biden being Obama's VP counted more than a lot of people, including myself, anticipated among voters. And also, you know, we've talked at various points about one of the things Obama was best known for and that Booker is also known for is kind of that optimistic message. And when you're running against Trump, how much are voters really hankering for an optimistic message? And to what extent, you know, with all the energy on the left in the party, to what extent, I don't mean all the energy, I mean just there's a lot of energy on the left in the party, to what extent is optimism confused for
acceptance of the status quo?
And just softness on policy, right?
Oh, interesting.
So I think both probably played some role. But again, part of me thinks that if you reran the simulation of this primary 100 times, that Booker is in the top tier in a big chunk of them. But I don't know. It's notable that, okay, as Nate was saying, in the top tier, The three candidates who came into this campaign with the biggest profiles are all in the top tier, and then we have Buttigieg. So maybe there was
Well, Buttigieg is the one where, like, I don't know how many simulations his name would come up.
That's what I'm saying.
That one's, although he did have the wisdom, I guess, to very explicitly say, I am carving out this middle lane where I am not Joe Biden, but I'm also not on the left. And I do wonder if Booker or Klobuchar had done that sooner, they could have gained more traction.
I think there's a weird, with the candidates that emerged out of the Senate, particularly, frankly, Booker and Harris, there was this kind of, and maybe a little bit Warren, I don't know, there was a little bit of this uncanny valley where you were kind of like, did you maybe believe too much hype about how progressive the
about
party
the
is
left,
getting,
yeah.
And then you got into the campaign and you said, yikes, maybe I misjudged that. There was something weird going on with that. I think that the Senate candidates in particular, I think.
It's notable that they all seemed to correct course at some point
right.
in the campaign.
Well, I totally agree with that. But also, to what extent does Booker being black, Harris being black, Klobuchar being a woman complicate any pivot to the center? We know voters see candidates of color, see women as more liberal than they are. So I wonder a little bit if, you know, if Harris, for example, or if Booker had made an explicit pivot to the center in the way that Buttigieg did, whether they would, because of identity, been left a little between a rock and a hard place, where you're turning off some progressive voters by rhetorically tacking to the center, but at the same time, a lot of, you know, let's say non-college educated white Democrats aren't giving you credit for moderation because of your identity. Does that make sense?
So the argument is kind of you would have had to come out of the gates as the big tent, somewhat moderate unifier, a la Obama, instead of coming from the left from the start.
Maybe that's easier if you – I think it probably is easier if you come out of the gates. But even then – I mean, we saw this. This can work to your advantage. It worked to Obama's advantage, right, where Obama was in a lot of ways a unifier. It was always talking about the benefits of compromise. But the left rallied behind Obama, right? So you can kind of be a – you can kind of be a cipher and be everything to everyone. And maybe if they came out of the gates, they would have been. But the opposite of that is like the Rubio problem, where you're nothing to no one, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, that marks the end of Cory Booker's run for the Democratic nomination. And let's talk about the state of the race in Iowa. But before we get to that, today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. It's definitely winter, and the thing about winter is that it's scary outside, but beautiful and cozy inside, especially when you're staying in with Casper. From award-winning mattresses to pillows, sheets, and duvets, Casper transforms the way we sleep and keeps us cozy all season. The Casper mattress is an award-winning balance of comfort and support. Four layers of premium foam are designed to provide pressure relief for all night comfort. From bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything you need to build the bed of your dream. And as always, Casper has free shipping and free returns. Plus, every Casper mattress comes with a 100-night risk-free trial. Start waking up on the right side of the bed. Get 10% off any purchase with a mattress today at casper.com/politics and use code COZY, COZY. That's casper.com/politics, code COZY for 10% off. Terms and conditions apply. See casper.com/terms. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as a national security advisor just for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions. Professional-grade systems for commercial-grade businesses. Businesses choose ADT Commercial. The Fortune 1000 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit ADT.com/538 to learn more. Again, that's ADT.com/538. We're back, and as I mentioned at the top, the recent Des Moines Register poll shows Sanders leading in Iowa within the margin of error at 20%, Warren again at 17%, Buttigieg at 16%, Biden at 15%. And the last Des Moines Register poll showed Buttigieg at 25% and everyone else in the mid-teens. So a significant shift since the last Des Moines Register poll, which of course is conducted by friend of the podcast, Ann Selzer. It's a high-quality poll, part of the reason we put a decent amount of stock in what that poll says. So, Claire, how much should the new Selzer poll kind of shift our conception of the race in Iowa?
Great question. And by the way, if listeners are not familiar with Ann Selzer, they can go back to, I think, the first like long piece I wrote for 538 in 2016. I profiled her, and I kind of talk a little bit about like the history of the poll and like what makes good polling, which I still think is a pretty good and accessible primer for this stuff. The title of the piece is Ann Selzer is the best pollster in politics. And some of what I talk about in the piece is just like how it's a high quality, old fashioned kind of poll in the sense of the Des Moines Register, to their great credit, invests a lot of money in this poll. And there's a reason why everyone kind of gets really excited when one of these comes out. And especially with so I think we should pay attention to this one. It also makes a lot of sense to me that there's been a big shuffle in the poll since the last time it came out, which, you know, it was the last poll that came out was a really good poll for Buttigieg, right? And now it's a really good poll for Sanders. And to me, that stuff tracks because in Iowa, you have a super highly informed group of voters. They've been watching the debates. They've been watching, say, the wine cave controversy, or is Elizabeth Warren flip-flopping? Is she not electable enough? Or Bernie Sanders is the OG progressive, and that's why you should vote for him, right? Like, there's this, they are super, it is a population that is incredibly attuned to this stuff. I was at an event outside Des Moines this weekend, and a voter literally recited back the results of the Des Moines Register poll to me. It was quite striking. So
that's amazing.
But I think that is indicative of the kind of high information voters that you're seeing in these caucuses. And so it makes sense to me that they're kind of attuned to what I think a lot of people have said is like the punditry of the Democratic primary.
Nate, now that we have the model, maybe you can give us a quantified answer to this question. How much should this new piece of information change our conception of the race in Iowa or even the race more broadly?
I think the answer is not that much. I mean, it depends, right? Because like, it's easy to like overrate the poll and say, oh, now Sanders is the front runner in Iowa. Well, now there's, you know, a four-way clown car in which he seems like a little bit more likely to emerge than, say, Warren, for instance, but not that much more likely to emerge. This is why it's nice to have a model, because you can plug the data literally into the model. Someone enters the poll, we press go. And in this case, I think it had Biden's chances falling from 41% to 38%.
In Iowa or overall?
Overall.
Okay.
And then Sanders went from like 21 to 23. I don't have this all memorized, but something like that, right? So, you know, it's not trivial. I would think if it went to 41 to 37 or 38, that would be somewhat material, right? But it's also like, you know, if you look at the prices on like betting markets or how much changes the national narrative. I mean, that's clearly, there are clearly also people who are overcompensating for it a little bit. And this is a case where sometimes we would say it's just one poll. You can almost kind of ignore it. Here we wouldn't say that because number one, it's a really high quality poll. Number two, have not been very many Iowa polls of any kind recently. On the other hand, like with the exception of Biden's number being pretty mediocre for Biden, to be honest, just 15. For the other three, it was kind of in line with where other recent polls have been. And so it's not that much of a shakeup necessarily.
Just in general, should we consider this anybody's to win of those four?
Well, clearly any of the four can win Iowa, which is not to say they're equally likely to win it, but like it's actually kind of closer to equal than a lot of things, right? And the question is like, which of those four is most poised to take advantage of an Iowa win? And the answer would seem to be in this order, right? Biden, number one, because Biden leads in national polls. If he gets a further bounce or even avoids an anti-bounce or whatever, right, then he's kind of in pretty good shape. Sanders, our model, likes his position in New Hampshire and Nevada, so that would lead potentially to three wins in a row, which would be a very nice position for him. You know, Warren is actually not that far behind Bernie in national polls and could use, frankly, a bounce, right? But like Warren and Buttigieg kind of like need like the bounce from Iowa, right? Biden doesn't need a bounce because he's already ahead, and Sanders needs like a medium-sized bounce to help him win New Hampshire and Nevada.
I actually wonder a little bit. It's hard to say because there's still 3 weeks to go until Iowa, and the media narrative and expectations can change so much in that time. But I actually wonder a little bit that our model showed that poll being a little helpful to Warren, actually. So I wonder if she's still within striking distance, whether the kind of expectations game is kind of setting up perfectly for Warren.
Well, then we get into kind of speculative. I mean, you know, one thing that is definitely true is that no candidate of the top four, or anyone obviously, is particularly close to like having won a consensus of the party, right? You have people who are getting nationally 27% of the vote in Biden's case. In Iowa, you know, it was a nice poll for Bernie, but he's still at 20%. And so the kind of question of like, who do you pick up after that, right? How do you go from 20% to 50%? That's kind of the question that kind of remains open for people. But yeah, I did like the poll for Warren a bit. She's also had some national polls recently that were like a bit stronger. And so maybe it is well-timed.
Claire, you talked about how close Iowa voters are to the campaign and the news cycle. Is there a candidate or a couple candidates who have a clear ground game advantage in Iowa? And is that reflected in this poll?
I would say probably most visibly, it's probably Sanders, Warren, Buttigieg, in part because those are the people with like, I mean, for Buttigieg, it's like that's they've made the investment. They've made the idea for their campaign that they have to win Iowa. They have to do well there. You know, Biden is the pragmatist candidate, right? This is not to say that he doesn't have a ground game, but it's like it's a little less word of mouthy kind of vibe of it's kind of people say if people are supporting Biden, it's kind of like, well, of course we're supporting Biden. He's the pragmatic choice. I didn't go out and follow canvassers around or anything like that. But that is my sense of like those are the campaigns that have probably the most like word of mouth or grassrootsy kind of, I don't know what the word is.
No, that support, I think that's right. But as Claire also said, Biden does have a ground game in Iowa, and we did a piece on this. But like the data suggests, at least in terms of like what you can really measure easily from the outside, that the top four candidates' ground games are pretty equal in Iowa. Again, that's at least in terms of what we can see from the outside. But it's just another example of like, has there ever been a point where there's been such a four-way pileup in Iowa?
Unusual to have four candidates who are that close in the first state. But again, though, Mayor Pete is way behind the other three nationally. And so like it's not quite like it's – but yeah, I mean it's pretty
– But in Iowa
– And by the way, one thing that's important too, speaking of ground game there, is that – so in Iowa – you literally line up into preference groups in the caucus. And if you don't get 15%, sometimes a little bit higher if it's a small precinct, but let's call it 15%, then you have to go realign with another candidate or try to steal like the small groups of candidates, the Steyer supporters or whatever else, right? And like I imagine there's a lot of skill in that process. And because you have, frankly, all four candidates, none of them are going to be above, if you're 20%, you know, that you're going to be below 15% in some precincts. It happened not to be your best precincts. And so all four of these candidates are going to deal with, like, this very close race where your skill at, like, persuading people to join your campaign from the Steyer camp or the Klobuchar or Delaney,
yeah,
right?
This is, like, the huge thing of the caucuses. And it's funny that Nate is bringing up Steyer. Again, like, I was talking to a couple of voters this weekend who said, we're committed to caucusing for Steyer, but they were at a Sanders event. And they were basically like, we're trying to figure out who our second choice is. And for Steyer voters, you're probably going to go with the second choice, right? So the idea of your first choice might be Amy Klobuchar, but who's your second choice? You know, is it Joe Biden? Is it Elizabeth Warren, right? Like those things do matter, you know. So it's kind of interesting to see, for instance, like Open Secrets, you know, published something last week where it was Warren and Castro shared the most individual donors, which is like an interesting proxy for, okay, in Iowa, not that Julian Castro was making such a huge splash, but the idea of like, who shares that support, right? And who can you perhaps count on and who can you target in an actual physical caucus room to say, come on over, we share a lot of values.
We talk, I mean, the media pundits talk plenty about ground game in elections. Is Iowa a case where it actually matters more than in a lot of other scenarios, or does it always matter? Why are we giving specific weight kind of to ground game in Iowa?
It always matters in the sense that elections are turnout and persuasion games, right? You want to have your people come out to vote, and the people that you don't have yet, you want to convince them to turn out. Iowa is so small It's all about, will you make a commitment to caucus with me? Will you show up for this activity that is sort of involved, right? I think it's, and it does, I think in that state, it does kind of become for people, it's like, ooh, your first time caucusing, right? It's like this thing. So the idea of kind of like hyping up people and making sure they turn out and like hoping it doesn't snow or whatever it is, like that is a big deal. I do think that that's true. And the other thing is the state is so inundated by ads and all this stuff that it does make a difference, I think, to these people who are, they're saying, okay, who have I actually, what campaign have I actually spoken to? Who came to my door? Who seems to be kind of putting the effort in?
Well, also just as Claire and Nate were saying, ground game always matters in like a general election. You know, it's like pretty marginal, let's say a few percentage points at most. But in Iowa, you get two bites at the apple, essentially. The ground game does to influence a race, right? It's who are you turning out to caucus? And then once the 15% threshold kicks in, you get another bite at the apple to, as these guys were saying.
Be in the room persuading people.
Exactly. So it's like it's kind of there's this extra ground game impact point, leverage point.
We're going to continue talking about the contest in Iowa. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Upstart. Between hitting the gym, eating healthier, or learning a new skill, there's lots of ways we can better ourselves in the new year. A great way to do that is by tackling high-interest credit card debt. Upstart.com is here to help. Upstart is the revolutionary lending platform that offers smarter rates to help pay off high-interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional credit score when addressing credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter rate. They make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rate. And the best part, once the loan is approved and accepted, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 400,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards and meet their financial goals. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes. And again, that's upstart.com/politics. We're back with our conversation about the state of the race in Iowa. And as we were mentioning, it's pretty uniquely clustered. And I'm curious, this time around, this means that somebody could win, get the plurality by, you know, 1 to 3 percentage points, right? You know, say the winner gets 22% and the next person gets 21%. In terms of delegate count, that matters very little. But could the fact that it's all so close just frustrate the message coming out of Iowa and make it less significant?
Well, there are also three different ways that's going to announce the vote count. They're going to announce the vote count when people come in initially before this realignment 15% thing. They're going to announce the vote count after that. Then they're going to announce what's called delegate equivalence, which is a traditional way of doing it, which is I think technically you are electing people to attend state conventions in Iowa, which then elect delegates to the national convention. So it's how many state convention delegates you're estimated to have. And so if it's very close, you could have, let's say, Biden leads in the initial preferences, Warren leads after realignment, and Sanders leads in state delegates, right? So you could definitely have like ambiguous outcomes that way.
And does that just mean that whoever spins it most successfully wins? Or does that mean that like New Hampshire is even more important and Iowa becomes a wash?
Look, if I were a candidate hoping to get a bounce out of Iowa, then this ambiguity would worry me. I put it like that.
Well, that makes sense, and I don't disagree with it. But you could also see it kind of helping someone get a bounce. You know, if the initial vote count comes out first, actually, will it?
I think they're going to be announced at the same time.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, even so, you know, you could imagine worlds where, let's say, Biden is ahead in the initial vote count, but then Warren is ahead in the reallocated one and the delegates one, that being spun as like strength for Warren in sort of like her being more acceptable to the other candidates. In other words, like figuring out who will get a bounce out of a state like Iowa is so complicated to begin with that I think the ambiguity here and how close it is could influence the bounce by dampening it, by just confusing it. But I could also see it like influencing the bounce by screwing with expectations and there's a bigger bounce.
I think it'll probably be that Iowa matters most to Warren and Buttigieg is my sense, because Biden and Sanders, I think, can make a stronger case for we got strong states coming up. We've got a Super Tuesday strategy in Biden's case. But for Buttigieg and Warren, for whatever, like Buttigieg, it's kind of obvious, right? It's like he staked his claim on Iowa. And for Warren, I think the accumulating factors of people worrying about her being quote unquote too liberal for a general election, the fact that she's a woman, the fact that there's kind of like a little bit of momentum against her, the Sanders team kind of pushing this, like she's the candidate of the elite. If you want to vote for a real progressive, vote for Bernie. He's the OG. To me, I have some sense, and you know, this could be off, I don't know, but that those are the two candidates that would be hurt or helped more by the results of Iowa, whatever they are. So because they are, I think, a little bit more vulnerable than Sanders and Biden.
How traditionally can we quantify what the bounce is coming out of Iowa? How does the model do that?
So it looks at both, do you finish first, and kind of what share of the vote you get relative to expectations. And we define expectations in a particular way, which is how your standing is in national polls. So if Buttigieg won Iowa, people be like, well, he's only at 8% in national polls, right? So therefore, pretty impressive. I guess he's a serious candidate now, right? So yeah, in some sense, if you're a front runner, you have more to lose than to gain in Iowa, right? Like Biden would surely, if you could bypass Iowa and strike that from the calendar, he would surely prefer to do that. Because even though he has a shot to win, most of the time he won't. And the downside's probably bigger for him than the upside is. Because the upside is that, hey, you're the national front runner and like you're supposed to win Iowa. Except I think he's like oddly kind of not perceived as a national front runner, even though he is. And so that's like kind of second order narrative stuff.
Claire, you already mentioned a little bit of the tension between the Warren and Sanders camp with regards to Sanders putting out talking points about, you know, Warren not being the original progressive
spicy.
And being the candidate of the elite. This is all actually going to come to a head in the debate tomorrow, Tuesday. Yeah. We're going to have a reaction podcast, so we're not going to preview it too much today. But what are the dynamics as things currently stand on that debate stage? Is the non-aggression pact between Sanders and Warren over?
I actually don't think either of them will be particularly confrontational with each other on stage. I actually don't think dispositionally they're apt to do that with each other. But obviously there's some real stuff going on there. And I think there is some truth to it, right, in the sense of white college-educated voters in the Democratic Party do like Elizabeth Warren quite a bit. And the demographics can be very different for Sanders and Warren support. I do think it's pretty unfair for the Sanders campaign to kind of say she's in the pocket of the elites, that kind of thing. But you know what? Talking to voters, you do hear people saying stuff of, why are you supporting Bernie above Elizabeth Warren? And people will say, well, I think she actually still has some corporate ties. I think she takes corporate money, right? Like, I think that sense is trickling in. And I think it comes from, fairly or not, the fact that her supporters do tend to be what I think was the demographic of a lot of Hillary supporters in 2016. And Bernie, that's kind of a classic Bernie tactic, right? Was go after, like, you know, these are the people who aren't for the systemic change that I'm for. Of course, you know, factually, that seems to be kind of a misrepresentation of Warren's entire campaign line. And she does have, you know, she's better black support than Buttigieg for sure. And so it's a bit unfair, but interesting.
It was a bit surprising, I thought, how she did push back. I mean, look, in some ways, first of all, the level of antagonism between the candidates is actually not that high compared to like 2008 or 1992 or years like that, or
we
maybe
could
even
get
2016.
There yet. We could get
we might.
There
yet. It's kind of frayed nerves that happens later on, right? But you have this kind of weird race where like the third and fourth place candidates have probably gotten more incoming friction than like the first and second place candidates. You know, I think the Sanders folks say, hey, the media dismisses our chances. Well, actually, it's kind of nice sometimes, right? Because your voters can feel like you're an underdog and you're aggrieved. And you don't get the same scrutiny that you might if you were perceived as the front runner. Certainly, the scrutiny that Warren got, what was it, like October, when it was kind of decided by the zeitgeist that she was the front runner now, right? I mean, you know, she got a lot of scrutiny and that shifted very fast. And like, so, you know, it's kind of a nice thing if you're, frankly, Biden or Sanders, and you're kind of a little underestimated. But I'm not sure that's going to continue on until the rest of the primary. And like, we definitely do, I mean, this is kind of what I think Micah was getting at before, you know, we definitely do have time for a shift in the narrative pre-Iowa. I'm not sure that who has momentum today is particularly indicative of who will have momentum 3 weeks from today.
Yeah. And, of course, our next stop between, you know, here and that day is the debate. So we'll see how this plays out and how the candidates either go at each other or don't, and we'll have our response podcast. But before we end today's podcast, I want to get to one of our favorite questions to ask. We planned on asking this at the beginning of the show, but we ended up talking about Cory Booker instead, and that's good use of polling or bad use of polling. And this pertains to Tom Steyer. So a Fox News poll came out showing Tom Steyer at 15% in South Carolina, second only to Joe Biden, and at 12% in Nevada, where he trails Biden and Sanders and is tied with Warren. And those are all big jumps from the last Fox News poll. Two types of responses to this poll were, one, incredulousness, and two, frustration from Democrats that a candidate could seemingly buy support in the polls. So let's discuss those two reactions as kind of the uses of this poll. First of all, do these polls seem like outliers? Is there a reason to believe that Tom Steyer has moved up so significantly in Nevada and South Carolina?
I think the reason to believe he's moved up is this poll. Fox News produces.
Thanks, Micah.
Well, let me finish. We hadn't gotten a poll in South Carolina or Nevada in quite some time, point number one. Point number two, Fox News polls are really good polls. And point number three, sure, could this be an outlier? Yeah. But it could be an outlier and Steyer still have gained, right? Just maybe not as much as these polls are showing. But four, there's like a real world theory that we have right at hand to explain his rise in the polls, which is he's spending shitloads of money advertising in these states. So I think there's reason to believe it's real for now.
Yeah, I think it's like, it's like maybe it's not a polling outlier, but it's potentially an outlier in life, right? And this,
it's a life outlier.
Like, but it's interesting. You know, I went and watched a bunch of the Steyer ads. And what's interesting is I think up until – like throughout this campaign, Tom Steyer has been known primarily for three things. One, he's a billionaire. Two, he really wants to impeach Donald Trump and has been saying that forever. And three, he really wants to make climate change his central issue. But if you look at a lot of those ads that he's running, they're ads about the economy. And they're ads about how Tom Steyer is a billionaire and he can take Donald Trump to task. So, yeah, he's probably one of a couple candidates on the airwaves there. But he's also making a kind of like non – like I think he kind of knows like – even though climate change is important, it might seem like a squishy issue to people. You know, it's not squishy. The economy. I'm a businessman, blah, blah, blah. Right. So that was kind of interesting to me. But I do think it's probably an outlier in life.
Well, an outlier in the sense of it's not true to say like he has the Nevada and South Carolina airwaves all to himself.
Sure.
But he certainly has them more to himself now than he will once Iowa and New Hampshire vote.
And also, right? Nevada is like kind of a transient. We're going to insult several of the first four states today, aren't we? It's a state that usually you have like a lot of people have moved there newly. You have low rates of turnout. It's also a caucus, so caucuses have low turnout in general. You know, it's kind of like a state where they're not necessarily like in the thick of things as far as like getting a ton of information about the campaign, and so that's maybe where advertisements move the needle more.
Yeah, it's. I mean, as far as caucus states go, Nevada is like the opposite of Iowa, where like half the people you'll talk to in Nevada are like,
there's a caucus?
There's a caucus?
Yeah.
When is election day?
And they get only about half the turnout despite having about the same population.
But look, our polling averages, which, you know, are meant to account for outliers to some extent, it's a little tricky because there just hasn't been a ton of recent polling. We now have Steyer at 8.2% in Nevada and 10.4% in South Carolina. So, like, that's not nothing. He leads Buttigieg pretty easily in South Carolina.
So for the, I guess, Democratic activists commenting on Twitter, for example, saying, you know, this is just an example of how you can buy elections. Is it as simple as money buys support in this case? And is it that simple in general? Are their complaints valid that he just bought his way onto the debate stage? He bought his way into second place in South Carolina? Or is it more complicated than that? Like the message matters et cetera, et cetera.
I think it's a little more complicated. I'm sure the message matters. I think it's probably easier to buy yourself a bump in the polls than it is to buy yourself actual votes.
Yeah, right. Because especially after someone does win Iowa and New Hampshire, then, I don't know. I mean, how soft is that support?
Exactly right. Right now, Steyer is kind of pushing on an open door. No one's pushing back on the other side. Soon, you know, at least three other candidates will be pushing back. But
he got himself a news cycle.
He got into the debate. So, like, their complaints are valid in that sense, sure.
And it's worth noting that he's spending a lot of money in Iowa and New Hampshire as well and not registering there. So it does look like when somebody is pushing back on the other side of the door, he doesn't get that same
support.
There's
a lot of I saw a lot of Steyer billboards and stuff, but I mean, I wasn't watching a lot of TV.
By the way, you know who's pushing on a door in a lot of states right now with no one pushing back?
Bloomberg. Yeah, I've seen his ads in New York, and New York doesn't vote until, April?
Max Rose just endorsed Bloomberg.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway.
And with that, I think we are done with today's podcast. So thank you, Nate. And again, happy birthday. Feel better.
This is like one of the shortest episodes we've done, I think.
Good episode.
All being sick kind of actually is a good strategy for...
It's still like a sizable episode. We talk about a lot of stuff.
It still took up a lot of my time.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen. Happy birthday, Nate. We're glad you were born.
Thank you. I'm glad that I was born also.
And shout out to Mrs. Silver.
Thank you, Mom and Dad.
Yeah, what about his dad? His dad doesn't get credit?
Well, his mom did more work on this day.
Ooh, probably
this day,
true.
26 years ago.
Undoubtedly true, in fact.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you. It was a pleasure spending my Monday morning with all of you.
And we've got a lot planned for the rest of the week, so let me give listeners a little bit of a rundown. We're going to have a reaction podcast to Tuesday night's debate. We'll also have the next installment of the Primaries Project out on Thursday. Also on Thursday, we have a live show in Washington, D.C., and there's just a few tickets left. So if you want to join us, it'll be fun. Head over to 538.com/live for more details and tickets. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.